Hi, I'm Brian Cohen.
And I'm H. Claire Taylor. Have you struggled to keep up with the fast-changing world of self-publishing?
Do you want to learn the latest news, tips, and tactics to help you sell more books now and into the future?
Welcome to the Sell More Books Show, a weekly podcast that gives you all the info you need to know in under an hour.
To save you time, give you motivation, and boost your publishing profit.
Enough waffling. Let's get started.
Okay, Claire, on with the show. Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Sell More Books Show, episode 331. I'm Brian Cohen from Amazon Ad School and Best Page Forward, and I want to thank Becca Syme for filling in for me from last week while I took the week off. And also here is H. Claire Taylor from FFS Media. How are you?
I'm doing great, Brian. I'm doing fantastic today. How are you doing? How was your break?
It was really nice. My wife and I got to go for some walks and hang out for lunch, and I ordered a lot of food, and I gained all of the weight.
Good.
So, all of it.
Well, then you're done with it. There's no more weight to gain.
I'm done with it. There is literally no more weight to gain. No, I'm great. I think when you have a big project, like you've done a lot of writing and you finish something or you have a big launch, it is helpful to schedule in a few days off. And I think you are one of the people who pushed me to take that time off after my challenge for July. So I truly appreciate that encouragement.
I try and do productive bullying. It's just a practice of mine.
Has been since you were a wee lass, productive bullying. But yeah, I'm feeling refreshed. I'm feeling good. What do you have going on? I hear you have a free course.
I do have a free course. It is the Indie Author Alignment 5-Day Foundation course. And it is free if you go to ffs.media/foundation. So ffs.media/foundation. And that is just about, you know, getting sort of your career goals and your persona and your fiction themes all kind of in alignment so that you enjoy your job that you do every day. Or if it's not a job yet, your hobby every day.
Yeah. Your hustle, your side hustle.
Yeah. Yep.
Which we'll get into a little later. I guess that's kind of more of a like 30-something entrepreneur term. Side hustle, man.
Right. I can't afford a mortgage without a side hustle. That's the 30-something entrepreneur.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I am excited for people to go check out that course at ffs.media/foundation. And I don't really have anything new and crazy. Already starting to prepare for the October challenge. And always looking forward to that. We have a winner of your paid Supercharge Your Story course, and that is Eve H. Eve, go email Claire at contact@ffs.media to claim your prize. All right. Our first patron, which is actually the same term we use when I've had a large amount of food, Symphony of the Wind by Stephen McKinnon. No, it's terrible. I know. I'm so sorry. A bounty hunter with a death wish, a girl with fearsome powers, a kingdom on the brink of destruction. Driven by revenge, Serena and Gallows must join forces to take down the conspiracy before the kingdom falls to ruin. Symphony of the Wind is the first book in a gritty epic fantasy trilogy if you like hardened heroes. Bloody action and dark magic and monsters. You'll love Stephen McKinnon's visceral adventure. That is Symphony of the Wind.
All right. And this one is about your daughter after she has listened to the Symphony of the Wind. Trauma-sensitive early education, helping preschool and elementary students thrive by Matthew Bennett and Sarah Bennett. Today, something is going to happen to an innocent child. Tomorrow, that child will walk into their school. What happens next will impact the rest of their life. What is this powerful event? Childhood trauma. Understanding the problem is just the first part of the journey taken in the book. This in-depth exploration guide guides educators in the process of creating trauma-sensitive classrooms and research-based instructional strategies that help students with trauma experience social and academic success.
And this third one is about my daughter going to therapy later in life. The Strange by J.B. Murray. Edgar Allan Poe, haunted, dark, mysterious, time traveler? A timeless nightmare stalks both the day and night. It's taken everything from Poe, compelling the man to traverse time itself in search of a savior. The Strange is a place where history meets fiction, and the two dance delightfully to the calliope of the supernatural, science fiction, mystery, horror, and suspense. Is calliope the right word there? I wonder. Cornucopia? I don't know. I'm just trying to think.
Right. I think that's one of the muses.
Ah, that makes sense then. I didn't know what that was.
I only know that because I just named a character that in one of my books.
Nice.
I don't know how to pronounce it, though. That's for the audio narrator to figure out.
Calliope or Calliope? I've heard it both ways. Mm-hmm. But that is The Strange by J.B. Murray. If you want your title roasted on the air, you can become a patron of the Sell More Book Show. Just go to patreon.com/SMBS and you will get the show approximately 8 hours early. If you become a patron, you will be able to access it a few hours earlier and then rip it and then share it with whatever black market
profit podcast off of us.
Places you can find. All right. Last week's question, where I wasn't here, was what metric would be a business change for you if Amazon could provide it? Claire, I believe you're up first.
All right. Amity Thompson said, like everyone else, some reliable data would be a huge help. How much can we trust the page reads in the end? I've seen time and time again when the rest of the data is wonky. Add to that the fact page reads are only reported in a 2-week window. That's not a long time, really. Still, something is something. As to a new metric, I'd like for the downloads to be tracked as they count toward sales rank.
I'm going to have something to say on these page reads in a second since I didn't get a chance to weigh in. Tori Element said, I can't answer the question quite yet as I have my first book in the editing process. However, I do have a thought about Amazon's providing page read data. I think they are worried about more authors going wide and with more platform options. That's a really good point, Tori.
And then Sarah Prow Blackard said, I'm not even sure. I think the business changer would be having accurate metrics. I've moved all my stuff to wide, so I'll be more interested in click to sell rate. But since that's not even accurate, it's hard to know what is going to be truly helpful or not. I think any metric that's truly useful will come from outside Amazon.
Great answers, everybody, and thank you for your responses. It was a good question you guys put together last week. I'm trying to think. I mean, I kind of agree with the accuracy that Sarah says. It'd be really nice to have accurate numbers, but for the reasons Amity mentioned with the 2-week window and then just in my humble experience as an author and an Amazon ad educator, Amazon misses stuff from time to time. And so if they even miss one, and I believe they miss more than one RO from time to time, it's going to throw off the numbers completely. So I think that the biggest thing I gathered from this is, as I mentioned to you off the air, if even one page read shows up, it means that someone borrowed your book based off that keyword or based off that ad, which is great. And we can use that. Anything beyond one, it's pretty much, you know, who has any idea how accurate it's going to be. But for now, just using even that one is helpful to know that someone from that keyword clicked the read for free button and then opened the book. And that's about all we can use that for to this point. That's kind of what I'm seeing. And I know, Claire, you and Becca might have had some thoughts on it, but I know that you similarly did not agree with the accuracy that it might have claimed.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing we know about the accuracy with the sales reporting is that it's not accurate.
But my conversion rate from these Amazon ads compared to these Facebook ads.
Hush, sweet summer child.
Can I send you to tell that to people when they bring that up? Hush, sweet summer child. Awesome. Well, how about we go into the tip of the week? And I believe I am up first.
And now on the Sell More Book Show, it's the tip of the week.
Tip number one, you do you. The best marketing plan is the one you will do, writes author Julie Glover on Writer in the Storm. You can save yourself a lot of heartache if you ask yourself a few questions while sifting through marketing advice. What are my marketing strengths? Which tasks do I enjoy? What marketing is necessary and what isn't? Which of the required tasks should I hire out and what pace is needed to accomplish them? Finally, it might help you to consider what would success really look like for you. Quote, consider what results you can expect given who you are and what you'll do. Ooh, that sounds like some really tough introspection there. Writes Glover, and not that part I added in. If that image is not the success you want, revisit and reconfigure the plan until you have something that represents who you really are. I just want to read that again. Consider what results you can expect given who you are and what you'll do. Those might be the most painful words you've ever shared on Sell More Book Show.
911, I'd like to report an attack.
I've been attacked by a podcast. What do you think about that, Claire?
I think a lot about that. That is what my free course is, because there is so much information and there are so many ways that you can do this, but there really aren't that many ways you can do this in the way that, like, you yourself, whoever I am talking to right now, has certain things that they're just not going to do.
Right.
So you can't make a plan that isn't fit to you. And she talks about what success is to you. And right. That looks so different depending on people's core motivations. So yeah, I agree with this. And it hurts. Feels really a little bit like a kick to the chest.
Yes. Yes. I definitely understand this. I think that you can trick yourself. You can trick yourself into doing things you wouldn't normally do, but eventually you're going to regress to the mean. And the way I look at it is almost like in those times when I trick myself, I scramble as high up the hill as I can and lock myself there when I start to feel the backslide, so that at least the next time I go back up, I'll be a little higher up the mountain. But man,
well, it's
tough.
It is hard because when you're like, I should be doing this, it's like, well, am I just not doing something because it doesn't feel good? Or is this actually not the right thing to do for me? Right. And so it's like, once you figure out what is right for you, then you can actually differentiate, am I kind of being lazy and just need to do this? Like, you're just not going to ever have a career that's 100% fun tasks all the time. You know, there's some stuff that you have to do. You have to do your finances. You have to, you know, all these things. You may not love it, but you have to do it. So once you can understand your, you know, what is actually tailored to you, what your career should look like, and what your success should look like, then you can say, I'm not doing this because I just don't like it, rather than, you know, like beating yourself up for not doing something that's just not right for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you have to distinguish between, you know, purpose and self-judgment. I've been reading a new book, Claire. This is my official recommendation to you.
Ooh, okay.
Positive Intelligence. So it's about kind of tapping into a little bit the inner wisdom versus the saboteurs that are always trying to kick your butt. And according to this author, everybody has a judge who is consistently judging everything they do and must be thwarted. And you have to decide, is this me going against my purpose, or is this just, wow, the judge is really kicking my butt right now? And it's really tough to distinguish, but this is why rushing ahead when you haven't had success doing the last few things you've tried, it's better to step back, assess, see where you're at, look at your strengths, look at your weaknesses, as I'm sure you guys talked about consistently on last week's show.
We just talked about strengths. Becca doesn't talk about weaknesses.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah, no, totally. I usually hear it talked about or referred to as the inner critic. That's what in my circles that I run with. And my little trick is if the criticism I am hearing given to myself by me talks about me as a person, it's wrong. If it's talking to me about a specific action, it's usually kind of right. You know, if it's like saying, oh, you didn't do the dishes because, you know, you're a complete mess and you're not an adult, then I'm like, I think that might be wrong. But then if it's like, you should do the dishes, you know, because it's like just a thing you should do and it's that time of day and you should, it's like, okay, yeah, that's good guidance. I can do the dishes or I cannot do the dishes. And I don't know why I'm giving dishes as an example. It's just something, I guess it's something I need to do right now.
Yeah. Your inner critic is telling you, you're talking about this on the podcast because you need to do the dishes.
Yeah.
That's great. No, whatever example we use, I think it's really helpful because you definitely need to try things and see what works for you to defeat the judge, the inner critic, whatever you call it. We are all waged in this consistent war and we're fighting these battles day in and day out. And we just have to try our best to keep on going.
Yes, I agree.
And it all starts with
baby steps.
There we go. Thank you.
All right, next story. Baby steps. When writing is a habit and not merely a goal, tackling a creative project as large as a novel becomes manageable, says author Lisa, I guess it's French, Poisson. She suggests James Clear's Atomic Habits strategy. Start with a habit so small you simply can't say no. Could you write an outline or sit with a notebook thinking about your novel for 5 minutes a day? Good, then increase your habit by baby steps. Quote, here are goals by breaking habits into chunks, writes the author. There's no need to pound out 500 words every morning. Try 250 words in the morning and 250 after dinner. Build up over time and you'll be writing more every day. When writing is a habit and not a goal, you don't have to rely on willpower or the muses to get you into the writing chair. A lot of talk about muses today, but I know you have
all in on the muses.
You have something to say about Atomic Habits, huh?
I love this book and I love the idea of starting smaller. And I think that I'm sure there are others like me out there who tend to only go big, always kind of going big or going home. But I found that the more I'm willing to do something just a tiny bit each day, and the more I'm willing to say that I don't need to be involved in every aspect of this as far as being a business leader, like, you know, there are authors out there, and I was one of them, doing their own covers and doing their own editing and doing their own everything. And it's a lot. And I know that not everybody has the money to outsource a lot of those, but there are hacks. There are ways to avoid putting all of the pressure on yourself to do the biggest, craziest thing you can think of. Sometimes a little bit every day makes a difference. And we talked the last month or so, we've talked a lot about email marketing. And email marketing is a very slow and steady get some subscribers at a time versus trying to get some big crazy giveaway and get 2,500 people. Sometimes just 1 to 5 a day makes the difference. And so I'm a big fan of James Clear for this very reason. And I think that if you do find yourself burning out consistently on your writing, this might be something to look to.
Yeah. And I was reading an interesting little article about how just the world we live in right now, there seem to be a lot of threats. And when people don't have that basic safety, you know, requirement met in the hierarchy of needs, or they don't feel like they do, long-term thinking becomes very, very difficult. And so if you don't have long-term thinking, creating long-term habits is like completely off the table. So it's just kind of becoming aware that like you can do little habits, you know, that there's a lot working towards you not thinking long-term right now, but you have to think long-term. So just, you know, take some deep breaths.
Yeah. Deep breaths are a good solution for a lot of things. All right, number three, we have a winner. After getting targeted with sweepstakes ads after a recent winery trip, that sounds fun, author Doris Maria Heilman is suggesting that authors can do something similar in their own marketing. A sweepstakes can build buzz, expand an audience, and sell more books. First, author should choose a prize that would attract your ideal reader, not just any old reader. Then use a contest tool that encourages people to share to increase their odds of winning. Ready to go? Promote your sweepstakes through articles, blog posts, send it out in your newsletter and social media. Take images of the prize and write and post about it, especially on Instagram, Pinterest, or Facebook. Contact each participant of the event and ask for a review of your book. Quote, authors might think that their hard work is done once they've completed the manuscript, writes Heilman, but to find readers for your masterpiece is often more complicated than the process of writing one. Well, I absolutely agree with that last point, certainly. This goes back a little bit to knowing yourself. I like sweepstakes. I like doing contests like this. I'm horrible at administering them. I like running them, and I like people being happy that I'm giving something away.
Right.
But it wasn't until I had like a team of people that I could do them the way I wanted to, which was the fun parts of them for me and hand off the parts that I don't like. So have you ever run a giveaway or a sweepstakes, Claire?
I have. I have done some through the King Sumo app.
Okay.
You know, when I just run them on my own and it's just my own stuff, it's very hard because I'm reaching my audience to try and give them my stuff, which for the most part, they already have. You know, and she talks about, you know, doing trips and stuff. Well, I don't have a whole lot of, you know, people in the area. And right now, leaving the house is not super easy. So right. The ones that I have done that have been successful are multi-author giveaways. And I think those tend to be what people lean towards. And then just stuff like book sweeps is so easy to jump in on. It's totally worth the, like, I don't know, $45, $50, whatever it is right now, to have someone else handle all of it.
Yeah, and we're big fans of Ryan Z on the show, and book sweeps does a great job. I think if you like this sort of thing, research it, do it. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with doing giveaways to your own audience every so often. Just make sure they're not incentivizing something like a review, which you're not supposed to do.
Yeah.
So cool. Well, let's get into it. I believe you are up first. We've got some fun pronunciations. And let's hop into it.
It's time for the Sell More Book Show Top 5 News. Number 5.
Do the Hustle. Is publishing a book a good side hustle? While everyone knows stories about authors who have made millions, there are also millions of authors who work for years on books that simply do not sell, says Side Hustle. Experts
Which has a dollar sign.
It's got a lot going on. Thanks to Roland, or whoever put the pronunciation there, Side Hustle. Experts maintain that the average book independently published sells just 100 copies. After costs, that would likely net the author less than $500, which is hardly worth the effort, especially if you calculate the hourly rate. And most traditional deals aren't any better. That doesn't, however, mean that book publishing is a waste of time. While it may be a questionable pursuit on its own, publishing a book could be a good side hustle if it supports your main job. Quote, the hourly rate for book writing is terrible, says Jane Friedman. That doesn't mean it's not worthwhile. Authors can use their books to attract clients or secure speaking gigs. Marketer Chris Huntley advises differently. Quote, if you want to make money on a book, don't think about book sales. Think about getting people into a funnel where you can sell them what you actually want to sell them. In the end, what drives you to writing and publish? If your goal is simply to earn money on book sales, you have got to have a strategy to write what sells in order to make it worth your time. At this quote, the hourly rate for book writing is terrible. Yes.
It's true.
It is. Don't think about it.
That doesn't mean it's not worthwhile, but yeah.
Right. Yeah. But that's not fun math.
Well, it's the hourly rate for everything. You were talking to me off the air about working on your course, and I've worked on courses, and now I redo a free 5 to 6 hours worth of content every quarter. And just because something is 5 or 6 hours means it takes like 3 to 4 times as much. So every quarter I'm redoing a 20 plus hour project for a free event. And so it's like, you could look at that, just look at that initial and say, wow, Brian is stupid. But
but don't say that, guys. Don't be mean.
Don't be mean. But if you look at kind of the long-term goal of it, it's a lot different. And obviously, I use that to reach a lot of people, and I do get some premium students as a result. But with your fiction, and I know many of the reader, the listeners here are writing fiction, it's got to be more about getting lifetime readers rather than trying to get someone who reads one book once and never talks to you again. And that's where that quote from earlier about the marketing being harder than writing the book itself comes in. In order to make this not just a $3 an hour job, a lot needs to go into the foundation of your business.
Well, and I think it also says a lot for the importance of purpose and passion if you're going to do this job. Because if you're just doing it for the money, might I recommend anything else? So you really want to make sure that it's something that you don't mind spending all these hours on.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Bitcoin mining.
Yeah. Just like that.
I just love Bitcoin mining.
Yeah. Bitcoin prospector.
I don't know what the diddle-diddle is because I really don't know what Bitcoin.
That was you hacking into the mainframe.
I think you need a CPU of some kind, but I absolutely agree. If you don't want to do this deep down, if it really is just an effort to get a little bit of extra cash, there are many things that are more lucrative.
Right. Well, and I know how hard you work, and you wouldn't do it if you didn't really love the teaching and the interacting. You would be doing something else.
Right. Bitcoin mining.
You would be Bitcoin. Sure. Well, you'd have to figure out what Bitcoins are.
First, step one, Bitcoin mine. Step two, question marks. You'd step be like, three, okay. Profit.
So I guess I don't need this shovel after all.
And I just bought a new shovel that said Bitcoin on it. All right. Yeah. I absolutely agree. Let's hop into number four.
Number four.
Howdy, partner. I've been watching a lot of Toy Story. Getting another set of eyes on your manuscript is critical. Without having outside input, vital issues easily slip through the system, says Black Wolf Editorial's Judy Moore. But who should you rely on when it comes to finding someone to read your book? A critique partner. Or a beta reader. Depends on the stage of your book, says Moore. A critique partner, often another writer, is typically looking at your book early on. They're looking at developmental issues, and because they often see the manuscript while it's still being written, they may be referred to as alpha readers. A beta reader, on the other hand, is usually reading the manuscript as a whole and providing feedback as a reader. If something doesn't make sense or something doesn't work for them, they should be highlighting it, but may not be able to explain why it didn't work, just that it did not. When it comes to finding your readers, it can be tough, although easier than finding a good critique partner. Quote, there is a significant amount of trial and error involved, says Moore, which is why I call it critique partner dating. It is important that you find someone who gets you and your writing. The wrong critique partner can ruin your story before it's even written. Claire, I feel like it's funny when I read the story that's obviously intended for you, but when you were starting out with your, like your standalones before you really got into the series, did you utilize either of these and how did you do it?
So let's see. My second book, which was really my first indie published book, I ran that whole thing through a critique group. So I was part of a critique group way back when, and we would workshop each other's stories once a month, and, you know, I'd give them a few chapters and they'd give me feedback, and it was very helpful. And it also helped me learn in critiquing other people's, what, you know, kind of, I had to deconstruct a little bit and say, okay, yeah, this isn't working for me. Why isn't it working for me? And I think that was a really important tool that I later used for all of my editing and, you know, the stuff that came after. Yes, everyone, I think, should start with a critique partner. It can help with accountability, but make sure you get someone who's nice to you and make sure you get someone who is not going to try and make it their story. So I think those are two important things, because sometimes you get in a critique group and maybe you're writing in a genre that this person just doesn't like, or, you know, they just don't like bear shifters. They just, I don't know, maybe one broke their heart at some point. So they just don't like them. And then they're just going to, you know, be like, oh, well, I thought the bear shifter was stupid. You know, so yes, you need one, but you really need to build up that relationship with a healthy, I guess just any healthy relationship. You know, don't get in a relationship that's not healthy, guys. That's from the column Ask Claire, obvious things. So yeah.
I'm still holding out hope for that bear shifter to come back into my life. But I think that that's super helpful when someone's starting out. We have a lot of people who don't necessarily like connecting with other people in our industry.
I get
it. Is it worth getting a developmental edit in lieu of a critique partner? Or do you think that both serve different purposes? I'm giving you the tough ones today.
Yeah, it depends on how good your critique partner is. Mm-hmm. Developmental edits are expensive.
This is true.
They're usually the most expensive form of editing. Because it's so in-depth and because it's such a feedback-heavy process. So, I mean, obviously, I'm going to say, before you even get to that point, come talk to me, because that's what I do, is I help people figure out the you know, spine of their story. So it's like,
right,
it's like coming up with a business strategy so you know what tactics to use. That's kind of what I help help people come up with their fiction strategy, you know, get that protagonist and theme nailed down so that they can make those decisions. And the decisions are easier because there's a lot of decisions. But, you know, so talk to someone who is smart. Don't just send your manuscript to someone without them asking for it. Don't expect free labor, but, you know, unless you're giving in return. I mean, if you have a really good critique group, you probably don't need a developmental edit. And there's also, like, just the whole thing of, well, publish it. And if it gets terrible reviews, take it down and fix it. Yeah.
Right. Right. I think people get caught up and they feel that there's a finality to publishing that used to exist that does not exist so much anymore.
No, I mean, if you're not sure about it, publish under a pen name and then you can just republish later. You can take it down, do whatever. I know a lot of people use multiple rounds of editing on their first manuscript, not so much as like, I really want to get this right, but as a, you know, avoidance tactic. So that's another thing. You don't need to be putting $10,000 into your very first novel. You're not going to make that back. If it's just a hobby and it, you know, fine, but you're not going to make it back on your first one.
What about the beta readers? Do you find beta readers
helpful? I love beta readers. Yes. But you have to know, I mean, she talks about it in this, but you have to know, because they're not going to be able to give you like super specific feedback.
They'll tell you when something is wrong. Yeah. They just won't know why.
Exactly. So you kind of have to have that understanding yourself, or, you know, it's an opportunity to learn.
Right. Right. That's great. Super helpful. Let's go into number three.
Number three.
Cancel culture. Cancel culture isn't just something that happens to TV and movie celebrities these days. It can come for anyone, writes author Thomas Umstadt. Tens of thousands of Twitter accounts recently attacked J.K. Rowling, angered enough to swear off and burn her books, and even trying to get them pulled from publication. Umstadt says that cancel culture can hit a person regardless of where they lie on the political spectrum, from misunderstandings or mistakes, and it can even come from staying silent on issues. In the latest episode of the Novel Marketing Podcast, Umstadt talks about some of the things authors can do to protect themselves from cancel culture, starting with not being a jerk. People who are quick to cancel others are often eventually canceled themselves, says the author. Be true to your readers from the beginning, so they're not shocked to discover the real you down the road. And when it comes to the trolls, don't feed them. There's virtually nothing you can say that will help. They want to misunderstand you. Finally, once something starts, realize that most firestorms don't last long. Most people will forget about it in a few weeks, as long as you don't keep fueling the fire. Of course, it's still important to protect yourself should your enemy succeed in canceling or deplatforming you. So diversify your income, own your website, and maintain direct communication with your readers by building an email list so you'll still be able to sell books even after losing your place on someone else's platform.
This is heavy, Doc.
Yeah.
But it is happening to some people.
Yeah, to some people.
A lot. Not like 10% of the population is canceled every year or something. It's some people who you can usually tie it back to a choice made recently or a choice made in the past.
Or a choice made at any time ever.
A choice made at any time ever that comes back and can really lead to former fans turning against you. And I certainly have seen it happen in my life. I've seen it happen with other people, with friends, with authors, certain authors. When you talk about the deplatforming, I think about some of the authors who were removed from Amazon, and that was in a way, a canceling. This has happened, but I think it comes back down to don't be a jerk.
Well,
it comes back in a lot of cases.
Yes,
in a lot of cases. I'm not talking about 100% of the time.
Right, because I think you can still not be a jerk and still be canceled.
This is true.
It implies that you have done something to deserve it, which I have seen is often not the case. Mm-hmm. You know, you can just do something that someone else doesn't like. And that doesn't mean you're a jerk. But I think the main point, yeah, is own your platform.
Yeah.
And if it starts happening, Chris Syme has a really good book on this. She does this professionally, dealing with crisis management. I think it's called something like Crisis Management for Authors or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of the same tips. Like, just don't respond. First,
right,
you know, 24, 48 hours or whatever, don't do anything because you're only stoking the flames. Mm-hmm. And it really is like, I don't know about you, Brian, but there's sometimes like a celebrity will pop up like a trending topic. I'm like, I feel like they did something, but I can't remember what it was.
Right. The time healing that wound.
Right. And then I find myself yet again Googling, you know, Richard Gere and being like, okay.
Oh, right. That's what he did. Hilarious. Yeah, you're right. It isn't always don't be a jerk, but...
Well, that's a good rule to live by anyway.
We've seen sometimes where if someone had not done something, if you worry that when you post something, that if it's shown publicly, you will get in trouble, don't post it. Even in a group, a message, a text, or whatever. You just want to act like your parents would have wanted you to act in a situation. Okay. I mean, or the role models in your life.
Right. Act with integrity. Well, and this goes back to the idea of a lot of people being unable to condemn actions like separate of the person. Mm-hmm. You know, like if someone does something that is just kind of skeezy, you can say that was a skeezy action. And if you do say that, a lot of the times people will be like, you don't get to criticize this person. They're great. They're fantastic. They're a great person. It's like, okay, I'm not like great people can do skeezy stuff. Just like, you know, I mean, it's, you know, if you say like, oh, they did this great thing and people are like, oh, but they're a terrible person. They're not redeemable. It's like, but this is action. Like we're looking at this action, you know? So I don't know. It just shows sort of like a knee jerk emotional immaturity, in my opinion. Obviously, maybe I'll be canceled for that. I wouldn't know. I don't pay attention anymore. I'm knee deep in creating a course. Go ahead and cancel me.
Cancel me in a couple weeks. I'll emerge from my course cocoon. Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head. Not being able to disconnect an event or an action from the actual person, almost as if every single action they do is connected up with their soul or something like that. But obviously, Everyone, I think back to that Kacey Musgraves song of just biscuits, if you want to look it up. But everyone has their skeletons in their closet. And when you are canceling someone, you almost make this assertion that I am perfect. I have never done anything wrong. This person has done wrong and they should be condemned for it.
Right. And then you become more nervous because you've participated in something that could come back to bite you.
Exactly.
Yeah, it just seems to me, it's just go do your own thing. You know, go do your own thing. We don't have, you know, you can even have people who believe something bad and shouldn't be canceled. They should be educated. It's like, what is the goal you're trying to achieve, right? Do you want this person to stop doing this bad thing or do you want to punish them? And there's this idea of people being allowed to punish someone extrajudicially that is kind of like, okay. I was also reading about how actually low serotonin levels lead to people being more ready to punish someone and to decide punishment for someone. So, you know, check your serotonin levels. Go take a nap instead of canceling someone.
Nobody's perfect. We've all lost and we've all lied.
You're looking up the lyrics.
Most of us have cheated. The rest of us have tried. The holiest of holies even slip from time to time. We've all got dirty laundry hanging on the line.
Oh, man. Now I'm thinking about my dirty dishes and my dirty laundry. Thanks a lot.
I know, right? Well, we better just jump in. Before we get sued, let's jump into number two.
Number two.
What do we owe you? Patrick Rothfuss is getting a lot of flack for not writing his next book, writes Book Riot's D.R. Baker. Rothfuss is one of many famous authors getting bad reviews, being hounded on social media for the pace at which they're writing. It's been 9 years since the second in Rothfuss's trilogy was released, and the third installment is nowhere to be seen. Rothfuss, meanwhile, has an ever-increasing public profile with appearances at conferences, YouTube channels, a podcast, and an active online presence that lets everyone know just how much he's not writing. That's making readers angry, and their reviews and comments are scathing. Some are promising to pirate the next book rather than give the author any money. Quote, "My advice," said one fan, "is to give up on this author since he doesn't seem to care about his readers," end quote. At the same time, Rothfuss has occasionally posted about his battles with depression, all of which calls into question what authors actually owe their readers when it comes to books. Quote, "Being a fan of things is great," writes Baker. "It provides reliability and comfort to our otherwise hectic, even banal lives. But the next time you feel agitated because the next installment of something you enjoy is late, I urge you to remember the human on the other side of the transaction and that creators don't all owe fealty to your expectations and they don't owe you books." Claire, do you agree with this quote?
Well, I think it says a lot about how important fiction is to people on a very deep level, that they feel betrayed that someone has not finished this made-up story for them.
Right.
But I mean, I get it. Like, as an author, I feel bad when I take a little too long to write a book. You know, when it's like, oh, I've been putting them out every couple months and now it's like a big lull and I'm just like, sorry, guys. You know, or you get the people saying, when's the next one coming out? And you feel that sort of urgency, but.
Right.
I mean, it's our job. You know, it's like, it's our work. It isn't who we are. If he has depression, like, I feel like that's probably a pretty good excuse. And the people who are going to pirate his book because he didn't do it fast enough were probably going to pirate it anyway.
Well, I feel like people who threaten that they're going to pirate are going to forget about it because they obviously don't pirate books. If they're just like threatening, well, I'll go pirate the book. Then it's like, oh, I forgot about it one day later.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't know. He's doing all right. He's got money. I don't think anyone's obligated to do anything. There are plenty of people who never finish series.
Yeah.
I think it's great that he has such, you know, I guess loyal fans, as loyal Is loyal the word when they'll turn on you?
Inspired, motivated, agitated, addicted fans.
Jonesing fans?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, give me that next Patrick Rothfuss book. I'm scratching my neck, by the way. You can't hear that. I don't know what Foley we can get going on the microphone. Here, let's try. Oh, got to get that next.
He's not jonesing. He just has hives.
He just has hives. He's just allergic to leather, which is perfect for our number one story.
And now the number one top five news item.
Leather weather. Brandon Sanderson has raised over $6 million on Kickstarter, making his campaign the most successful publishing Kickstarter ever, reports Allies Dan Holloway. While most authors will never hit these levels, there are two important takeaways: the importance of building a fan base and the value of retaining as many rights as possible. Sanderson's Kickstarter is producing leather-bound special edition versions of the 10-year anniversary edition of The Way of Kings, a book that most purchasers have likely already read. But since Sanderson retained the rights for a special edition hardback, he was able to sell direct to his fans and make far more than he would have ever been able to make with a traditional publisher. Christine Catherine Rush points out that Kickstarter campaigns like this show just how disruptive authors going direct to their fans can be to a publisher.
I was seeing this in the rounds. I considered buying one, and then I looked at the price. I'm like, I never even read this book. So,
well, and that's interesting because people who haven't read the book don't want it.
Right, right.
Exactly. So it's exclusively then for people who have already read the book.
Who just want it on their bookshelf. And in a way, let's go. We went with what do authors owe their readers? This is what do readers feel as though they owe their favorite authors? And in this case, the readers felt as though they owed their author several hundred dollars for the super edition. I think there was over $100, I think. Possibly for, I'm forgetting exactly what the prices were. I looked at it, but more than you'd pay for a regular book in a regular bookstore. And they paid it willingly, happily.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
That's great. He knows exactly who he's selling to. And he has a big enough audience for it. I know Dean Wesley Smith is doing a big push for Kickstarter. And he has a free course for people who want to learn how to launch fiction stuff on Kickstarter. So it makes sense that Christine Catherine Rush is talking about it, being his wife. But yeah, I think it's interesting. I think Kickstarter is an interesting idea for fiction because it's, you know, it's financing before rather than hoping you make your money back.
Right. Yeah, I think that what a lot of authors don't understand about Kickstarter is that need for the audience ahead of time. Mm-hmm. They see the 6 million and they're like, Kickstarter. Yeah, I forgot about that. Let me get that back going. That idea I had in my head. But Brandon Sanderson has a lot of people who follow him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's been around. He's been teaching, you know, writing forever. He has a huge audience. And that's the thing. If you're having a hard time getting people to buy your $2.99 ebook, you're not going to be able to sell them a $100 hardcover.
Right. Right. Price is an expression of value, the value that you perceive that you're giving and the value that your reader or your fan perceives that they're getting. A reader who would pass up your book at, like you just said, $2.99, who went and bought Brandon Sanderson's book for $100, they perceived that you were giving a deal that they didn't find valuable, but they perceived the Sanderson deal as valuable. And that is in part because they feel a deeper connection with Sanderson, with his words. They've read his books. They've been on his email list. They've taken his classes. Whatever it is, they liked the look of leather and they wanted it on their person and on their shelf. And yeah, they just saw that as more valuable. And if you ever want to sell higher level things, you are going to need to make that value case as well.
Right. I think this could work for authors for, you know, if they have a really big following, you have a big list, it's very active, you could do a Kickstarter for audiobooks, right? To get it into a different format for something that's a little bit cheaper. So it's like, oh yeah, you know, $10 for an audiobook. If you're getting it produced, you can easily, you know, $10 is cheap for an audiobook. So, you know, people would buy into that. And you're just doing the like audio files. So, okay, your audiobook's going to take $2,000 to produce, whatever, $2,000, you know, that's 200 people jumping in. And you already know that your expenses are going to be paid. So for something like that, especially smaller, you know, obviously you want to start smaller, but to take your existing fans and give them something just a little bit more expensive that is new, that is a new way to experience it, I think this is great.
I absolutely agree. And it's good. This is the top, you know, like when you have this many fans, this is something you can do. Now, the last bit that Christine Catherine Rush brought up that we didn't really touch upon, look at Brandon Sanderson self-publishing a leather-bound edition of his traditionally published series because he retained the rights to do a special edition hardcover. Now, not every agent could probably negotiate that. I imagine he has a very good one. But big time traditional publisher self-publishes special edition is what this could have been called. And it's pretty epic, and it's got to put a little bit of fear into the establishment, because anyone who has a big audience could do this in the future. And if they see that, they could say, oh, my next book, I'm just going to kickstart it and I'm going to make more money than your advance.
Yeah, I think that that is a huge takeaway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, a pretty punk rock way of living your life.
Right.
And it's one of those things that, like, they probably didn't even think to do special edition hardcover, you know, like, oh, why? We don't need the rights for this. We're never going to do this. And then it's like, oh, sneaky.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's like J.K. Rowling retaining the rights to her ebooks.
Oh, man, that was so baller.
Yeah, whoops. Probably should have signed on that, but you know. Yeah.
Well, they just thought ebooks were magic at that point, so.
Right, right. And they just didn't believe in it, yeah.
Osseo ebooks. So,
typical muggle publishers.
We need a question of the week. I feel like we've discussed a whole boatload of things today. So yeah. I'm not really sure if you want to talk about leather or if you want to talk about what readers and authors owe each other. Cancel culture. I don't really want to talk about that.
No.
$HUSL. I don't know. What are you interested to know the answer to?
We keep touching on individualization in this and making sure that you have a plan that is individual to you and what you will actually do. So right. Maybe something about
so you're
that.
You're bringing in the real tough question.
Yeah, I want to reduce everyone to tears.
I know.
We all need to go cry anyway.
Sell more tears podcast.
We will sell your tears. Maybe something like, what is one thing that you're doing that may not fit into your strategy that you could drop?
I like that.
Have we done something like that recently?
I feel like we did something similar. So maybe we'll add a second part to that question.
Okay.
So what's something you're doing right now that you could drop from your routine that isn't really helping you? And based on the knowing yourself concept, what's something you like doing that you would want to replace that old thing with?
That sounds great. Something that you wouldn't mind doing for $3 an hour.
Yes. You can answer the question of the week at sellmorebookshow.com in the comments for episode 331. Claire, I hadn't mentioned it in a while, but I'm so excited that you and I are going to be doing a live Sell More Book Show episode.
Yeah, I totally remembered we were doing that.
Yes, you did, because I sent out emails about it today. We'll be doing a live Sell More Book Show episode as part of Self-Publishing Live, and that'll be a blast. And then you'll get to talk about wonderful things about story during the Self-Publishing Live event that did become virtual, but I just booked a hotel right across from Wrigley Field where I will be not being interrupted by Riley 27 times during the event.
That's a fun little stay workcation.
Yeah, definitely work. But yeah, that'll be, I did get the room with a view. So I'll be sharing Wrigley Field views throughout from afar. Socially distant views to Wrigley Field.
We get to see the baseball players playing to no crowd.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think the view is that good.
Oh, okay.
So, looking forward to talking to everyone who is going to that event in our live show.
God, you lined up some great speakers. I'm really excited about that.
Thank you. Yeah, me too. We've got Inez Johnson and Lindsay Baroker and Joseph Alexander and roped in Chris Fox at the end, as well as we have some cover design breakouts led by Mariah Sinclair and some blur breakouts led by the BPF team. It'll be a jam-packed couple of days, and that'll be really, really fun to do from a hotel room if the Wi-Fi is good enough. Otherwise, all 4G all the time, people. So, Claire, do you have any last words of wisdom? I feel like we were really in your zone of genius today talking about the plan for what you should be doing versus not necessarily playing to your strengths. Every week I'm going to put you on the spot. It's great.
God, I have to have new wisdom, but wisdom's supposed to be timeless.
Timeless wisdom.
Oh, yeah, I guess. But I guess, you know, just maybe try and listen to your inner critic and let them know that you're doing just fine. Thank them for trying to watch out for you. Thank them for trying to watch out for you and then say, I got this.
I like the thanking. That is very nice. I it's a kind way to treat that jerk that lives inside of you. Cool. Well, thank you, Claire. Great episode. And definitely check out Claire's course at ffs.media/foundation. And we'll be back next week for episode 332. Until then, have a great week of book selling. We will talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Sell More Book Show. Visit the website at www.sellmorebookshow.com for detailed show notes and subscription information, or to send us news or comments for use on the show. Also, please take a moment to subscribe to the show and leave us a review. Thank you very much for listening, and happy book selling!